Hello and welcome to the third season of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name is Lewis Webb and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. This season we'll also be showcasing some of the area's musical talent, with tracks from local artists being played in each podcast. This week we hear from singer-songwriter and multi-talented instrumentalist Harrison Lana Main. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. To mark the upcoming Somerset Day on the 11th of May, this week my guest is the founder of Somerset Day itself, Nigel Muirs-Raby. Growing up in a farming family, Nigel has always been an advocate of the rural way of life and has seen the tremendous potential in uniting Somerset and its people around a day to celebrate produce, culture and business around the county. Nigel's career in the arts and business world also made him an ideal candidate to breathe new life into one of the county's most historic properties, Cothelstone Manor. This year's Somerset Day has seen a wide campaign to get people celebrating their county by flying the flag for Somerset. Nigel, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
This episode is going live a few days before Somerset Day, which, as we all know, is on the 11th of May. But we're recording a couple of weeks in advance. How are the excitement levels building up?
Building up really well, actually. It's particularly given that we've got a very difficult year because of COVID. It's amazing the engagement we're getting. We're delighted, actually. You know, we didn't quite know what to expect, the same as last year. So yeah, no, it's very good, actually.
I'm a bit curious on one thing, really, which is your family name is quite an interesting one. Can you share some of its origins?
Well, yes, I'm told. I mean, Raby is obviously there is a Raby Castle up in the north of England. As they used to say many years ago, I think we were probably born the wrong side of the blanket. But I'm told that Muirs is derived from people who used to keep the mews in, you know, which where the stables and things always were, of course. But our particular connection was that it was my grandfather was a Raby, he was Canon Raby, and my grandmother was a Muirs. And when my father was born, he became Muirs Raby. not as exciting as it might be.
If my research is good enough, your middle name is after your paternal grandfather,
yeah,
is that right?
That's right, yes. Well, your research is very good. I'm impressed.
It's interesting because my middle name is actually after my great-grandfather on my mother's side as well. So I like family names, yeah, and kind, yeah, of seeing where they pop up again.
I mean, our youngest son is actually, he's Jack, and My father was called Jack by my mother, although he was actually Jonathan.
You have an older brother as well, right?
I do indeed, yes.
Yeah, by 8 years?
Yep.
How was that growing up? Did he look after you or did he kind of...
I think it's... my memory for my early youth is not particularly good, although I do... I mean, I was very lucky. My parents were farmers. We had an idyllic childhood living on a farm. I mean, really was wonderful. But of course, in those days, you know, boarding school was quite a big thing. And so we both were away from quite young ages. So I didn't see, and particularly for me, my older brother was well into his boarding school by the time I was growing up. So we were sort of, perhaps didn't have a huge amount of time together, but we do. I mean, we see quite a bit of each other. We get on well, but I don't think it was. I couldn't say that, you know, he was around a lot because he wasn't. And then he went and joined the army, which of course meant he was around even less.
What were your hobbies and loves growing up then?
I absolutely loved farming. I mean, it was my passion. I wanted to be a farmer. My father said, you can do anything you like as long as it's not a farmer. they had a relatively small farm and it was hard work. I mean, it was all sorts of mixed farming, but, you know, a lot of livestock. And I always wanted to do that. And I still to this day love farms and farming. I mean, it's a big part of my life.
You mentioned boarding school. You're an old Harrovian. Harrow, of course, has a phenomenal history and heritage. What do you remember about your time there?
I suppose the sort of, I certainly remember, you know, the one thing that Harrow is particularly famous for is it's Harrow School songs. And that's, you know, that was a big part of both being a Harrovian and an old Harrovian. I didn't particularly enjoy my school days. Compare myself in that sense with Winston Churchill, because he's an old Harrovian and he hated the place. Although he went back, just before and during the war a few times, but he wasn't particularly happy there. Boarding school was tough in those days.
Again, if I've done my job properly, you were at school with a chap called Ewan Cameron, who is one of Somerset's previous High Sheriffs, and now his appear in the House of Lords yes. as well. Did you cross paths?
Yeah, I haven't seen Ewan for quite some time, actually. But yes, no, when he lived here, because he's moved to Cornwall now, but when he lived here, he was very much a part of the sort of, you know, the scene that I was around, and a really nice chap, actually. And he's done a huge amount for Somerset and for the rural way of life.
You started your career at another British institution, shall we call it that, the art auctioneer Christie's.
Yes, yes.
In that time, you must have been up close and personal with some of the world's most extraordinary pieces of art.
It was an incredible time, actually. I mean, Christie's and Sotheby's were still quite old-fashioned when I was there. I mean, they've changed hugely now because they're so much into the sort of very, very rarefied area of sort multi millionaires. But when I was there, it was very much around the old English families because they were still very much in evidence then. And you know, you met some extraordinary people. You saw some extraordinary places, some wonderful houses. I mean, part of my time was actually to do with valuations of country houses, and I went to some great country houses. I was also at one of the most famous sales that Christie's ever had, which was when they sold a Rembrandt, which came from, I can't remember who it came from now anyway, but it was the first painting, first work of art any sort that was thought to be potentially making over £1 million. And that stage, I mean, it's you know, nowadays, I mean, £1 million is nothing, but then it was a really, really big deal. Such a big deal that it was an evening sale, black tie, the sale rooms were packed, absolutely packed. And the painting was the last lot in the sale. Christie's refused to give any estimate on it because they didn't want to jinx it in any way. But there was a hope that it might just make £1 million. And when the auction started, I mean, you could have heard a pin drop in that room. I mean, there must have been 100, 150 people there. It was absolutely deathly silent. And the auctioneer, who was the chairman, Peter Chance, very old fashioned, you know, he started the ball rolling and it soon went to £1 million and over. And as it crept up, I mean, it was just, you could hear people gasping each time it sort of went up. I mean, it finally got to 2 million, which was absolutely unheard of. And at 2 million, the chairman said, another one? And the whole room collapsed in laughter because, you know, it was just sort of so unreal. And the hammer came down at 2 million. And the Evening Standard headline the next day, it happened to be the same day there was an assassination attempt on the Pope. And the Evening Standard had a picture of the Pope saying assassination attempt, but the banner headline above the whole lot was £2 million art sensation. So it was quite an event. I mean, it really was the beginning of a new order in terms of what's happening in the art world.
By then, did you have your own sort of taste in art that had been developed and refined, or?
Christie's was a very odd place. You didn't necessarily go into the department or the area you wanted to. And my interest was in English 17th, 18th century furniture. I mean, that was all I loved. After I'd done my sort of stint on what they called the front counter, which was the reception, I was offered a position in the contemporary art department, which couldn't have been much further from the area I was interested in. But I did my stint there, and then I did a bit of time in the silver department, and then ended up in the furniture department and valuations department, which is a really interesting bit because I was seeing so many wonderful wonderful houses and wonderful things.
During that time, I understand your father passed away while you were still relatively young. How did that affect you?
It was a very emotional period. I mean, he was young, and I was young, and I think it was a big loss. Because I was in London, and he was ill for quite a long time, actually, I perhaps didn't see as much of him as I'd have liked to have seen during that time. But of course, when he became very ill, I went home and was home for some time. And it was a challenging time. And your first real experience of someone close dying is quite a shocking thing because it's not just you that's affected. It's you know other members of your family and your mother, all that sort of thing. So yeah, it was a tough time.
Was that a catalyst for moving away from London? And
I don't know if that was a catalyst. I mean, I always intended to go to London and spend some time in London. But because of what, my love of the countryside, didn't really want to spend the rest of my life in London. And I reached a point at Christie's when I got a bit of a crossroads, I suppose, really. And they just started to appoint regional representatives, which again, completely new for them. And they've had one vacancy in the West Country. And I said, I'd really like to go for that. And they said, well, we don't want you to go for it. We see bigger and better things for you here in London. And I said, well, you may do, but I don't. And I want to do that job. And they said, well, we want you to stay here. So in the end, I said, well, actually, I'm not going to stay at all. And I left and came back home and then went to Cannington to try and follow the thing that I loved all along, which was farming.
Was that what finally brought you back to Somerset?
Yes, then? I mean, absolutely. I came back to Somerset. There was something called a TOPS scheme, which was a retraining scheme the government help fund. And I did my year at Cannington. And then I did. I worked on a farm in Curry Mallet, milking and doing all the things that I'd done when I was much younger, or seen when I was much younger. But it was always a dream. I mean, I didn't have the problem with farming is that unless you are lucky enough to inherit a farm, it's actually very, very difficult to go into it because there are very few tenanted farms. And so I think it was a dream, and it never really went anywhere. But perhaps I got something out of my system.
There are a number of things that we could spend a lot of time talking about in terms of the types of organisations, companies, initiatives you've been working for during your time in Somerset. And it's probably enough to fill another podcast. But what I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about is the fact that you've been lucky enough to be a custodian of one of the county's Grade 1 listed buildings, Cothelstone Manor. How did that come about?
Well, it came about in a rather strange way, really. I mean, we'd sold our house and we were living in a rented accommodation. And basically, we used to go to church at Cothelstone. I knew the people who owned the estate, and they'd just moved out, and we were chatting. I just said, what's happening to the manor? And they said, well, we're looking for a tenant, and are you interested? I said, no, not the slightest bit. And then at the end, we became interested, and I absolutely loved it. It was a wonderful experience. Very, very hard work. And it was and is an amazing house with a lot of history.
What is the history of the property?
It dates back to Elizabethan times, but it was heavily destroyed in the Civil War, it was rebuilt in the 19th century, pretty much on the pattern of the original house. The gatehouse wasn't damaged, and still is a very important surviving Grade One listed building. Aren't a lot of those sort of gatehouses around, and it had only been in the hands of two families since 1066, which was, you know, quite something.
That's amazing. 1,000 years of ownership just between two families.
Yes, yeah, it was amazing. Is amazing, interesting enough that the current owners of it only came to it in the sort of 1780s, you know. So their tenure is quite short compared to the Stoll family, who had it before.
While you were a tenant there, you also sort of created a visitor experience.
Yes, yes.
What sort of history and heritage did you want people to feel and go through?
Well, I think the big thing for us, it's a relatively small house by country house standards. So, and it's totally unsuitable for unguided tours, if you follow me. So it couldn't be open on a general basis. So we decided that the best thing to do was to do group tours and give people the opportunity to actually see what it was like to be guests, if you like, for an afternoon in that sort of house. So we very much about, you know, this is our family home, this is where we live, you're welcome as our guests. So do, you know, feel free if you want to sit on a chair, sit on it. If you want to read a newspaper or a magazine or a book, do please do so. There are no chairs are roped off. And what we wanted to do is create a totally different experience to the National Trust, who whilst they do a wonderful job, my personal view is that those houses are no longer homes. I mean, they are now just mausoleums or monuments. And particularly given the way the trust is now going, God help us all. I mean, you know, because they don't represent what they were. So I think we were doing it in a different way. We were giving people an opportunity to see and feel and be part of being a guest in that sort of house. And actually, people really, really loved it. I mean, they would say, you know, how much they'd enjoyed. I mean, I remember one quite old gentleman, just as they were leaving, he came up to me, he said, grasped me by both hands and said, thank you so much. You've made my year. And I just thought, my God, you know, it was quite sort of emotional. And I think, we were doing something that was a little bit different. I mean, not different to what most of the people who own or live in historic houses, what members of what they call the historic houses, used to the Historic Houses Association, now historic houses, because they are lived in and they are a living, breathing being. So I think, you know, there is a very important role for these houses that are still lived in to demonstrate that they are still alive and they still do have a place to play and a role in the local community, which they do.
How far away did people come from?
Oh, I mean, the vast majority were sort of Devon, Somerset, Dorset, Gloucestershire, but we used to get some from a long way away. We did even have one German group, which was terribly, terribly difficult. They had absolutely no sense of humour whatsoever, and despite the fact that both I and the interpreter worked really hard to get them to enjoy themselves, I think they would. I don't know. It was an interesting experience. It was the only tour that we ever had that we felt that was awful. All the rest, at the end, we said, God, that was so nice. And what I was struck by was how nice people were. I mean, I'm amazed. I mean, everybody who came, they were just delightful and so grateful.
The other person in that equation, I suppose, that we haven't talked about so far is your wife.
Yes.
Because it's very much a sort of a joint partnership in showing people around. How did you divide up the responsibilities and what was it like working together?
It worked quite simply because I don't mind the sound of my own voice. So I did all the tour and the talking and all that bit. And the other thing we did, and this was very much her sort of part, was that we decided that we should always give them, nine times out of 10, it was a tea at the end of the tour. And so that was very much done by us. Finney would prepare it all. We did sandwiches and cake and tea, and we had a big kitchen with a round table in the middle, and it was all out on the table, and people came in and helped themselves. So it was very much sort of, you know, it wasn't like a sort of commercial tea room. They were invited to come and have tea with us, effectively. And so it sort of changed the tone from a sort of, you know, talk about the history of the house to, you know, just being with us and chatting away.
Before we get on to talk about Somerset Day, I did want to find out how you ended up at the Queen's Garden Party.
I think it was, basically what happens is that you are approached, first of all, by the Lord Lieutenant. And I think because I am, because of my involvement with Somerset Day, and also I was on the Somerset Committee of the Army Benevolent Fund, you know, we were asked if we would like to go, and of course said yes, we'd love to go, and we were told we would be put forward, and then eventually you get an invitation from the Lord Chamberlain. And we went, and it was a wonderful experience, absolutely amazing. And actually, I've been terribly lucky, because when the Queen came here a year before last, when she came to Bruton, I was asked to, there were 100 people from across the county who were asked to have lunch at Bruton with her. And that was another wonderful opportunity. She's an amazing person. And I think what strikes one both at the garden party and at the lunch is just how much it means to people. It is an incredible thing when you're asked to go to something like that, and everybody there is so, I think they just feel that something it's special. It's an important recognition, but not so much a recognition, just an amazing thing.
As a new feature for this season, we're showcasing Somerset's musical talent with tracks from local acts in each podcast. Ever since the age of 13, Harrison Lana Main has been earning his stripes as a troubadour around the west of England. However, in more recent years, he's expanded further afield, at first with gigs in Europe, then moving as far as North America and the Caribbean. 2019 took him to the next level when he made it onto The Voice, reaching the knockouts and being mentored by Ollie Moores. Harrison has written and produced the majority of his discography, and this is his 2020 single, Impossible to Feel the Cold.
Can't seem to drift out. I've been running in circles around again. Man, this is too much. I hope to see that face again. The time went so fast, but we made the most of the slice we had. In the streets they sang glory, no worries or trouble in wonderland. Take me back to that moment, just our backpacks and the road. The sky was lit up by the starlight. We had no place to go. Hail, storm, rain, or snow. know. You made it feel impossible to feel the cold. Impossible to feel the cold. It's close to 5:30, and still my brain's wrapped around your frame. I didn't think this would hurt me, but you left an impression pretty stained. Take me back to that moment, just a backpack and the road. The sky was lit up by the starlight. We had no place to go. Hail, storm, rain, or snow. You made it feel impossible to feel the cold. Just our backpacks and the road. Lit my sky up with your starlight. I know where I wanna go. Take me back to that moment. Just our backpacks and the road. Lit my sky up with your starlight. I know where I wanna go. Feel impossible to feel the cold.
You're the founder of Somerset Day. Yes. Where did the idea come from?
It started started by me and was called Passion for Somerset. And I started it because I just felt that as a county, we weren't recognising what we had here. And I think there are some long-standing reasons why that's the case. One of them is this motorway that comes down through the county, the M5, which takes a lot of people through and onto what they see as the West Country. The predecessor to that was the A38, which was always jammed solid at weekends, so people just wanted to get through Somerset and get on past it. And the other thing was when they broke the county up by creating Baines and North Somerset and Somerset County Council. And so we lost the historic county in a way, because, you know, for a lot of people, if you live in Taunton, Bath is another country, and the same people who live in Bath. And so Passion for Somerset was started with the simple aim of trying to recreate, if you like, a sense of belonging to this wonderful historic county, which is a remarkable place. I mean, it is the foundation of England. It's older than any county in England. It's older than any state in Europe. And so I felt we needed to be giving that some more prominence in a way. And then an extraordinary thing happened. We were sort of talking about what we would do. And then a very nice lady, Bishop's Lydiard, called Kathy Ford, sent a tweet out saying, why doesn't Somerset have a day? Other counties do. And Kit Chapman, the Castle Hotel in Taunton, picked it up and said, this sounds like a great idea. And we all said, yeah, it's a wonderful idea. So how do we go about getting a day? and that's where Tom Mabry comes in, because we thought, well, we better go to the person who best knowledge about what we should celebrate. And we decided that we'd have a competition and that we'd throw some different dates in the air. And Tom gave us three dates. He gave us St Dunstan, he gave us King Alfred, and he gave us the Battle of Sedgemoor. And we put it out to a poll, an online poll, and we had, I think, 8,000 people take part. At one stage, we thought the Battle of Sedgemoor was going to come top, which was a bit alarming because it was a defeat. anyway, at the end of the day, it turned out to be Alfred the Great. And actually, it couldn't have been a better date, really, because I didn't know at the time all this wonderful history around Alfred the Great. I didn't know that he'd marched them. He gathered all the people of Somerset out of the marshes in Athelney that he'd taken them to fight the Danish army, the Viking army, and defeated them. And that out of all of that, he became ultimately the king of the English. And he was the first monarch to have their head on the coin. He's the only monarch in British history to be called the Great. He might not be. I mean, there's always a chance. I think future generations may well name Elizabeth the Great. But certainly, currently, he's the only monarch to be named the Great. It became a big thing for us that here was something we could coalesce around, something we could celebrate and really go to town on, so to speak. And that's what we've done now since in the second 2015, I think was the first year we had a Somerset Day. And it's just been, you know, we've been growing it. I mean, we're tiny, you know, we are very much one man and his dog, a voluntary board, not-for-profit CIC. But, you know, we are making progress.
And the 11th of May, I believe, also sort of, it's not just King Alfred that pops up on. There are some other days that are of other dates of significance that the 11th of May kind of pops up again.
There are indeed. The 11th of May was when, 11th of May 973, that St Dunstan, Archbishop of Canterbury, conducted the coronation of King Edgar in Bath Abbey, which is an occasion of great significance in the history of the English crown. It was the first coronation of an English king for which any kind of extended record survives and still forms the basis of the coronation service used in modern times. And St Dunstan, or Dunstan, was born at Boltonsborough in Somerset and was abbot of Glastonbury and then became Archbishop of Canterbury. And also the siege of Taunton ended on the 11th of May, when the royalist forces suddenly withdrew. And it gave rise to a rhyme that was chanted in the streets of Taunton long afterwards. "Rejoice ye dogs, 'tis the 11th of May, the day the Cavaliers ran away." So, yes, I mean, it's a significant, you know, it's a significant month for Somerset, and it's a significant month for our country.
When it was first conceived as an idea, what kind of ambitions did you have for it?
Gosh, I don't know, really. I suppose my main sort of desire was to try and help remould the historic county identity, if you like, to try and get people to think about Somerset as a whole, rather than the bits that it seems to be thought about now. Because, you know, if you look at places like Devon and Cornwall, I mean, they have a very strong county identity. Yorkshire, I mean, you can't talk to a Yorkshireman without him boring you to death about what a great place Yorkshire is. But if you talk to somebody who's born and bred in Somerset, they're very withdrawn and very quiet about it. I mean, they love their county, but they're not out there up front with it. And I think what we wanted to try and do was to just demonstrate that actually, as a county, we have more than most counties put together. I mean, you know, we're the breadbasket of England. We have more farm, food and drink producers than any other county, 8,500 at the last count. So, you know, we have amazing national park, several areas of outstanding natural beauty. You know, I mean, I could go on for ages. I mean, you know, the largest music festival in the world, one of the greatest carnival sites in Europe. You know, we've got so much, and yet all of them are individual things and not complete. I think what we wanted to try and do was to sort of pull that together and make people recognise that actually there's more to Somerset than just its parts.
What's been the best thing about how it's grown over the years?
I suppose it's just that there is a growing awareness. And we have a long, long way to go, but there is a growing awareness. I think in a way, there's been a lot of talk about the damage that the COVID epidemic has done and how hard it's been, which of course it has been. But it's also provided a lot of opportunities for businesses and people. And I think one of the things that's come out of it for us is that, well, two things have come out of it for us. I mean, back in the first lockdown, we decided that we needed to try and help people find local businesses where they could get food from effectively when it was so difficult to get from the supermarkets. So we started something called Shop Somerset. At the start of the second lockdown in November, we had 110 businesses on it, and we decided it was time to put it onto its own website. Well, we've now got 360 independent businesses. So out of what we started, we've started to build a community around our independent businesses, and they're key to the future of our county because they are part of the communities in which they live and do their business. And I think the other thing that's sort of come out of it is this flag, because we didn't have a flag. We do now have one. And what we've done this year for the first time is to give that as the theme to Somerset Day, because we recognised that there would not be very many events this year, or thought it likely there wouldn't be. So we decided we should have a theme, and we took the idea unashamedly from things like Comic Relief and the Coffee Macmillan Cancer Macmillan Morning. And so we've gone for this thing, Fly the Flag for Somerset, because that enables people to celebrate Somerset in a COVID safe way. And I think actually it's probably going to be, I don't know, I hope it's going to be one of our most successful years to date at the end of the day.
You might not know this, but there's a reason that our Somerset Stories background and branding is yellow. It's very much inspired by the Somerset flag. So to some extent, we're flying the flag all year round. As you mentioned before, it's a not-for-profit organisation. So what does success look like for you?
I think success ultimately looks like, I think, two things. The growth of the continuing growth of Shop Somerset. I mean, we do want that to become the online platform for Somerset's independent businesses. We believe that with the changes that are taking place on the high street, our independent businesses need a wider platform, both within the county and further afield as well. So we think that's one measure of success will be how many we, you know, get on there. And I mean, you know, it's growing fast. I think another measure of success will be raising the awareness of Somerset Day itself, so that actually it really does become a big celebration for people across our county, and not just in pockets where it's been, you know, particularly strongly supported. I mean, there are some places where they really, really do it fantastically. And there are other places where it doesn't touch at all. So we would want to get it everywhere.
What are you most looking forward to about this year's Somerset Day?
Well, I think I'm hoping that it's going to be an opportunity for the people who live in Somerset to actually have a bit of a celebration. I mean, we've all been through some pretty difficult times. We're all shut away in our homes. We've not been able to see our friends and our family. As we move out of lockdown, and we're just beginning to come out of it now, and more is happening. I mean, May the 11th is before the next step in lockdown, so it's still very, very limited. But I hope it will be an opportunity for people to actually be proud of something and actually celebrate what has been good about what's happened. So we very much focus this not around, you know, how tough it's been for people, but around, look, actually, there have been some amazing things that have happened during the whole lockdown period. And one of them has been the real bonding of communities and the awareness of neighbours of their neighbours. And I think we hope that we can get as many people as possible hanging a flag out, putting a bunting up, putting a sticker in their window just to say, hey, it's Somerset Day, let's celebrate this county, because we have got things to celebrate and we have got a future to look forward to.
There's been an influx of new residents to Somerset over recent years, some of whom have generated headlines because of their fame. What would you say to someone who will be experiencing Somerset Day for the first time?
Well, I'd say I hope you understand why it's important, and that actually there is so much to Somerset, to the reason we celebrate Somerset Day is because we have so much to celebrate. We are very lucky to have such a wonderful county to live in. And perhaps people who come to live here, and one of the reasons they've come here is because they think it is a wonderful place to come and live. So I would say to them, actually, do get engaged, do join in, because you will have so much more, you'll benefit so much more living in Somerset if you get involved and engaged with what's around you.
I think I've said this to another guest, but it's often those sort of fresh eyes that arrive in the county, and you know, maybe they haven't been here their whole lives, but look at the county and really appreciate all of that, you know, amazing stuff that you've explained, and are able to sort of express that excitement to people who maybe take it for granted to some extent.
I think that's absolutely right. I think what's really interesting is that, you know, if you look at, one of the biggest investments in Somerset in recent years is this amazing project, the Newt, which is a remarkable project. I mean, it really, really is. I mean, it's something on the scale of the great English estates of the 17th and 18th centuries, places like Chatsworth and Blenheim. I mean, it's on a mammoth scale. This chap, Koos Bekker, is investing in the future. He's building for the future. He's not going to see half of it himself. But what he's celebrating is what Somerset's all about, which is its produce, its people, its buildings, its landscape. And it, as you rightly say, you know, it's somebody from outside who's come in and identified that there is so much here that he's created this place. And he's done it in South Africa with this place at Babylon Storum. And he's, you know, we should be very proud that he's chosen to come to Somerset, because he could have gone anywhere. But the reason he came here is because, you know, he's all about what the county, the land produces. And, you know, we have these two amazing products in cheese and cider. But as I always say, actually, if you look a bit further, we've got a hand in almost every product and produce there is for us to live and to eat and drink.
There's another project which you're spearheading to showcase that great produce and businesses in the area, and that's the House of Somerset.
Yes.
What can you tell me about that venture?
Well, that's something that I and my fellow director started about 6 years ago, with the aim of being a showcase. I mean, it's nothing to do with Somerset Day, but it was the aim of showcasing what we have in this county to the millions who travel through Somerset down the motorway. I mean, there are 98 million long-stay and short-stay visitor trips down that stretch of the motorway, all heading for the honeypots of Devon and Cornwall. And if you think about it, there's a lot they're going down there for, which we could offer them here. So the idea behind the project is to provide a point where they can stop and enjoy and see and take away with them, and then next time come back and stay in Somerset for longer rather than going on down into Devon and Cornwall. It's been a long haul. The planners have been and are a complete nightmare. I sometimes wonder whether they really do believe in the future of the county that they purport to want to see grow and prosper. But you know, hopefully we'll get there in the end.
Finally, I suppose to wrap up, what are the sort of two or three things that you think everyone around the county can get up to support and celebrate Somerset Day this year?
I think it's terribly simple, actually, this year, because you can't do a lot else anyway. It is to, if you haven't got a flag, go to the website and click on a link there. I mean, we've linked with a company who have got a base in Wales and on Exmoor. I mean, this is another bit of Somerset, which is so interesting. You know, the chairman of Red Dragon Flag Makers, a chap called Robin Ashburner, lives on Exmoor, and he is the world's leading authority on flags. So we have him here in Somerset. He was the man who worked with me on the competition to design this flag. So and they've done a special deal. I mean, they're doing a printed 5-foot by 3-foot flag for £10. So, you know, it's not expensive. But there's also opportunities on the website where you can download your own flag, which you can print off and colour on your printer, or you can colour yourself and put it up in your window. A local printing firm are producing a sticker pack with a window sticker, a car bumper sticker, and some lapel badges. So there's plenty of opportunity for people to either buy or do their own flag, or bunting, or sticker, or whatever it is, and just put it in the window. You know, just hang it from your garden gate. You know, stick it in your car. Just show that you are part of this this day.
I am pretty sure that I'm going to get my my two little kids to, you know, to draw their own version of the flag.
Which is what we hope people will do. And in fact, what we're also doing is we're just about to send out to, we work very closely with BBC Radio Somerset, and they're going to be doing a competition. They're going to have 500 window stickers, which they're going to give out to people. We're just about to send out a pack of stickers to all the primary schools. Well, certainly in the Somerset County Council area, with a little note about what Somerset Day is about. Because we're trying to get everybody aware, and it's about raising awareness as much as anything else. And yes, I mean, what I do hope is actually that, you know, whilst there are plenty of opportunities to download, to buy flags and stickers and bunting, the thing we've done on the website is to produce templates which people can colour in themselves. And so we're really hoping that, you know, lots of children will have some fun and colour their own Somerset flag and put that up in the window.
Before we go, you mentioned the website. It would be really helpful to maybe spell out exactly where people can find out more about Somerset Day, you know, maybe on social media, the site itself, the hashtags that you're using, all of that kind of stuff.
The website is www.somersetday.com, and that will take you immediately to a Get Involved page where you can download all this material and see more about it. We've obviously got Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and we post regularly on all of those, and we'd love people to follow us and send us some. I mean, one of the things we certainly want people to do is to send in their photographs of what they're doing, either in the lead up to Somerset Day or on the day itself, so that we build up a big picture of what people are doing.
Nigel, thank you so much for your time. It's been great chatting to you and finding more about your own story, as well as the great initiative for Somerset Day this year.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories, or email hello@somersetstories.com. Music on all Somerset Stories productions is created by Jazar, who can be found at betterwithmusic.com. See you next time.